Today, I have the pleasure of discussing with Margherita Della Valle, CEO of Vodafone Group. Vodafone is a brand like very few others, one with truly global recognition. Launched in 1985 with one of the first UK cellular telephone licenses, Vodafone quickly grew to have a global presence, building and acquiring operations in Europe, the US, India, Africa, and more. Today, Vodafone represents 45 billion euros of revenues in fiscal year 2023 and employs about 94,000 people. It is the largest pan-European and African telecoms company, connecting more than 300 million mobile customers, 28 million fixed broadband customers, and 22 million TV customers across 21 markets and 48 partner markets. Vodafone also operates the largest 5G network in Europe, now live in around 300 cities across 14 markets, as well as the world's leading IoT service, connecting more than 150 million devices. Last and not least, with Vodacom Financial Services and M-Pesa, Vodafone operates the largest financial technology platform in Africa, serving more than 56 million people across six countries. My discussion partner today, Margherita Della Valle, has spent almost all of her career in the telco industry, including almost 30 years with Vodafone. She became Group CFO in 2018 and Group CEO in 2023. She also sits on the board of Reckitt Benckiser, a well-known international FMCG company. Margherita, thank you for taking the time to join us and a warm welcome.
Thank you very much for having me in your program.
Margherita, at IMD, our purpose is to develop leaders and organizations that contribute to a more prosperous, sustainable, and inclusive world. And we say develop leaders and organizations because we believe that both make a difference. But it's also true that the industry in which one operates makes a huge difference in how successful an organization can be. Now, in your case, on the positive side, the European telco industry has created huge amounts of value for its customers and for the world. The world is now incredibly more connected than it used to be in terms of access to data in all of its forms, in terms also of volume of demand that continues to show a very high level of growth. And all of this, of course, should be good news for the industry. But on the less positive side, it hasn't been easy, at least for Europe-based companies, to translate these greater volumes into more revenues and let alone profits and stock prices. Now, things have been significantly better for US and Chinese companies and some Japanese companies and maybe some from the Middle East. But first question, Margherita, why have things been so challenging for telcos and particularly Europe-based telcos?
It's only down to one single word, which is fragmentation, infrastructure fragmentation in particular, and a fragmentation which has been driven by regulatory choices, which are really very specific to Europe. Because we are so fragmented on the ground in Europe, we also are today in telco, the industry with the lowest return on capital of all European industries, whilst having the highest capital intensity of all European industries. And you can imagine that this is a picture which doesn't look particularly attractive for investment. To give you a sense of scale of the fragmentation, the average telco mobile network in Europe has 5 million customers. The same number in the US is 100 million. In China, half a billion. And why is this a problem? This is a problem because we have to sustain this very high capital intensity, this very high investment. Having fully fledged 5G networks is obviously very expensive, and you need scale to sustain these investments, which unfortunately doesn't exist in Europe. What you get in Europe typically is every territory, every house, every office in the mantra of regulator has to be covered by at least four different infrastructure to drive competition. And if we were talking here not about telcos, but we are talking about energy, for example, you wouldn't expect to find four different plugs bringing energy to every room to be a sustainable situation. But in our case, that's where we are. In a nutshell, the result of this has been that Europe has fallen behind on investment, and Euro consumers, but especially Euro businesses and the European economies, are now starting to suffer the problem of having much less invested network, which means lower speeds. We have fallen behind not just US and China, which you would expect, or the rest of Asia, but also most Latin American countries now have faster network speeds than Europe has, which is going to become increasingly an issue for the European businesses and economies that depend on the services that benefit from good network infrastructure.
Is there any relief in sight? Do you have the sense that regulators, European and or national regulators, are increasingly aware of the situation that you're describing? And do you have a sense that they're going to change some of their practices and policies?
You have used the right words. I think the level of awareness has increased significantly in the last few years. Particularly after the COVID crisis, people have started to understand that having well-invested telco networks is important. So I think policymakers are now very aware of the situation. Whether the regulation will actually change, I think the jury is out, but there is a big reflection going on, lots of studies being published. So I think the time is becoming mature for a rethink.
Okay. Now, one of the factors that I have also read about is this issue of over-the-top companies that are using infrastructure extensively, but are not necessarily supporting the cost of these infrastructure. What's your perspective on this?
I think the most important point in terms of how the usage of our network is driven is what I call the need to have responsible usage of the network. Today, as I was saying, the infrastructure is super fragmented, more than 100 operators in Europe, but effectively we are carrying the traffic of very few companies. You have the top six traffic generators, which are the over-the-top players coming principally from the west coast of the US, are generating more than 60% of the traffic in our networks, and it keeps growing. The problem with what I call responsible usage is that not all this traffic is requested by our customers or even experienced by our customers, because sending the traffic through our networks for these traffic generators is free of charge. They have a sort of open pipe that sends through feeds of videos that have been preloaded before the customer even thinks about what is the next video that they want to look at. And all this is contributing to big waste. Waste in terms of network investment for me, because I need to add capacity, but also energy waste, because we use energy to run our networks. And so I think it's time to rethink a little bit the balance and correct some of these negative externalities.
And this requires action by the telcos and or by the regulators. How is this balance going to be redressed?
I think it's a combination of the OTT players themselves taking action and understand that they can make a real difference to the use of resources and to the planet by self-regulating, and regulators themselves. And what is the balance? It's difficult to say, but certainly we need to find a solution.
One last question, if I may, on this. I was reading also about new technologies. Up until now, of course, telcos have relied considerably on hardware, physical infrastructure. And I'm reading increasingly about software-based solutions to expand network. Can you tell us a little bit about this new approach?
This is about the way we build our infrastructure. And something we have been working on very heavily in Vodafone and really pushing is what you are describing, which I would call a decoupling between the software component in the network and the hardware component. Today, there is a limited number of infrastructure suppliers. that control, if you want, the full product from software and hardware combined. By actually decoupling software from hardware, we create much more flexibility in our networks and much more choice in terms of supply base for those networks that will become effectively more efficient.
Now, in this tough industry, is it fair to say that over the last 20 years, Vodafone has not always outperformed all of its European competitors? Is that a fair statement?
Oh, for sure. The summary of what has happened is our share price has clearly been under pressure for a number of years, last 10 years in particular, last 5 years. Now, relative to competitors, it depends what is your reference point. And I would say that if the focus is Europe, so operators that are predominantly European multi-market operators that we are, actually you will find that, unfortunately, the trends have been very, very similar in terms of market and share prices. But this being said, there is a lot we need and can do better. And whatever is the environment, I was describing the situation of European regulation. Clearly, we can do better, which is why we are making many changes in the way we run Vodafone.
And I'm going to get to some of these changes in a minute, because indeed, you have come up with, I think, an exciting and promising and inspiring new strategy. Please allow me one or two more questions that are looking at the past. And the one I'm going to ask, of course, is a little bit unfair, because hindsight is always a lot simpler, a lot clearer, and a lot less ambiguous than real-time decisions. But if we look back over the last 20-some years, are there two or three things that we could say, honestly, we could have done these better? Are there some insights, some lessons that some of us can derive from some of the decisions that have been made by your predecessors?
20 years is a very, very long time.
And many, things, if you prefer.
Many things have happened. But if I look closer to home, you, I think, have read what we are changing and what my mantra is. And the priorities are within the company. And it's three areas: customers, simplicity, and growth. That's what we are focused on. And these three priorities come from things that we need to change and do better. And the most important one for me is really the service we give to our customers. I think that if you look at telcos in general, but certainly Vodafone in particular, we have not given our customers in the last few years what they mostly want from us, which is a simple, predictable, seamless service. Connections, disconnections, reaching customer operations for a query are all things that will sound like basics to you, but I don't think we have done well enough. And the reason for that is mostly we are very passionate about our technology. We have the best engineers. We have very large investments and we have a lot of focus on innovation, as you mentioned, but we have neglected the customer experience aspect, the operations that we run towards our customers. And I think there is room for doing much better in that space.
Fair enough. One of the areas where Vodafone has been very successful is the development and ramping up of M-Pesa, which was a significant innovation and has changed the nature of many African financial markets. Tell us a little bit about M-Pesa, how it came about and why it has been such a great success.
It's been a fantastic story, as you say. We now have the largest fintech platform in the continent in Africa. And in the markets in which we operate M-Pesa, over 50% of the GDPs of these countries is transiting through the M-Pesa service, which gives you the sense of scale. The starting position has been around opportunity to bring financial services to the unbanked part of the population, that in many countries in Africa was significant. In the end, everyone ended up with a mobile phone in their hands much faster than having access to any banking services.
Right.
It started off as peer-to-peer mobile money transfers, but it's now much broader than this. Companies pay salaries through M-Pesa, businesses manage their sales through M-Pesa, loans are made through M-Pesa, and it keeps expanding. Now 25% of our revenues in Africa are coming from financial services, and it's very, very fast growing.
Wonderful. Now, let's focus on today and tomorrow. Since you took over, you have introduced a number of changes, some of them pretty radical, a longer roadmap that features, as you said, three major axes: customer, simplicity, and growth. Where growth seems to involve at least two sub-pillars, on one side, right-sizing the portfolio, and on the other, also increasing the focus on the enterprise market. So we've already discussed a little bit the customer aspect, why it was necessary, and what you're doing about it. The second pillar, simplicity. What are you working on and why was it necessary?
Simplicity is all about becoming faster and more agile as a company. The first thing we have changed a year ago was the balance of activities and power between the markets and the group center. This is a topic that I think many companies grapple with, and there isn't a right or wrong way of doing things, but there is a right or wrong, again, to the point of what is right and wrong over time for a particular point in time. For me in Vodafone, it was essential to give delegation of authority on commercial decisions closer to the customers, again, to respond better to what the customers really want, which is in the markets, and making sure that the markets take full accountability for these decisions. This has allowed us to become just much faster in taking decisions on the ground and be competitive ultimately, but much more work still to be done.
Now, on the growth side, as I said, there's two angles to this. The first one is right-sizing the portfolio, and this has included selling off Spain and very recently Italy. You're also in the process of merging the UK business with a competitor. Please tell us more about this right-sizing.
The need for the right-sizing is coming from the point of fragmentation that we discussed earlier. Depending on how regulation has impacted certain markets, have evolved differently across Europe, and in particular, UK, Italy, and Spain were three markets where, for various reasons, Vodafone was not in a position from our starting point of last year to generate returns in excess of cost of capital, no matter how good, if you want, we would have been at running our company. And I think we needed to look at this very clearly and say either we can change the conditions of these markets or we need to exit these markets. And as you have said, there have been different answers. In the UK, we are effectively doubling up because we are working on a merger that will make the market sustainable and that will allow us to compete effectively and deliver returns at cost of capital levels. If I take the other extreme, Spain, incredibly fragmented, 5 mobile infrastructure, 5 fixed infrastructure, needs more than one round of consolidation. The best option for us was to exit. Now, the result of all this is that the markets we will continue to operate in, which remain a very large number of markets in both Europe and Africa, are all markets which have a growing telco industry as a field in which to play, and are markets in which we start from a strong position with a good scale, a good level of market share. So in each of those markets now, effectively, winning is in our hands, and it depends on how good a job we will do. And that's what we have achieved with reshaping the portfolio.
And so right now you're in 17 countries in Europe, Africa, plus India and Turkey. And so what you're saying is, if I look at these 17 countries, I'm comfortable that I have the right to win. Now then we have to execute well, but if we execute well, we should be able to be successful financially.
Exactly. And I need to invest And I need to grow where I can win. And that's where we are going to be now.
17 countries is still a lot. Would you be able to invest sufficient amounts of time, energy, attention in 17 countries? Or is that still spread a little thin?
I don't see the thickness or the thinness in this way. At the end of the day, in each of these countries, we do exactly the same work. We sell exactly the same product, broadly speaking. And we have an organization that is structured to be efficient in these conditions. So to give you an example, the way we build our networks in Europe, we have a single network organization that works, if you want, like a factory and builds the networks, which are effectively the same networks across the various markets. So similar to what you will find in, I don't know, an FMCG company. So the important point is not the number of markets. The important point is that they need to be market where we can indeed create value.
They need to have a healthy industry structure, but there's no diseconomies of scope.
Actually, the opposite is true. You talked earlier about there are a number of lines in which you said we are the biggest, we are the largest, etc. And there are areas where we can benefit from international cross-country synergies that are beneficial to us. A clear example is the IoT platform. We have the largest IoT platform in the world outside China, and there are some good synergies, for example, on running a large IoT platform as opposed to small ones.
Fragmented
and the
one.
Same is true for us in a number of areas, from procurements to operational back office, where we benefit from the scale of Vodafone.
Understood. And now the second pillar on the growth side is to increase the focus on the business/enterprise segment. Please tell us why it's a good idea, and also what are some of your competitive advantages in this area?
B2B is an area which has a very strong demand today in our world, because if you think about it, companies big and small across Europe and Africa need to digitize, need to transform the way they operate. And we have been for many years a trusted partner of these companies, bringing them connectivity services. And now with connectivity, we also bring what we call digital services. Let me give you examples: cloud, cybersecurity, those type of services. And if you are, for example, a small company in Europe, you need a simple set of services that a telco can bring to you. Today, Vodafone's revenues are 70% consumer, 30% B2B. But B2B is by far the fastest growing area. And the reason why I've called this out in the pillars of change we need to drive is I also need the culture of the company and the way we work to ensure that we allow for B2B to grow. A lot of our DNA is coming from consumer, and it's really important that we rebalance this to make the most of this opportunity.
And what are some of the differences? You said we need to change the culture, some of our practices, some of our habits. What are some of the things, for example, that would be very different?
First of all, the relationship with the customers is very different. Okay. And requires more time. Yes, a consumer transaction is something that can be executed very fast through a channel that can be also fairly simple. With businesses, sometimes you need to invest in the relationships. You need to also invest in the platforms, in the services. It's a much longer term approach, which has very good returns in our industry, but across different time frames than consumer. So if you are someone who has grown up, as many of our teams have done, in consumer, it's much faster to default to consumer habits, also because we are all consumers, so we understand consumer. Business requires a different level of competencies, of sophistication, which is why I also need to make changes in the teams. For example, I had to recruit a new CFO, and it's not an accident that I hired him from a B2B software company, because that's the type of competencies that we need to build to be successful in this world.
Understood. So more labor intensive, more solution, more joint solution development, and hence by definition also longer term, as opposed to we build an infrastructure and people plug themselves into it. Understood.
Exactly.
Now, as you know, Margarita, I'm a leadership professor, which means that I have to ask you a few questions that are more personal and related to your leadership journey. My first question on this front is, you were promoted to the CEO position from within, and hence you became the boss of a number of individuals for whom, for a few years, you were a peer. That's often described as an even more difficult situation than coming in from the outside. Any advice for the rest of us who are, like you, promoted from within? What are some of the things that you were mindful of and you've been working on, and some of the challenges maybe that this created?
I suppose there are challenges and opportunities on both sides. For me, actually, my experience has started with an interim phase as interim CEO. And I felt during that phase, actually, a very strong support from the organization, precisely because people knew me, I think, from before. I genuinely felt I was basically carried by our teams, and it was hugely motivating for me. I also had the chance to listen and speak with people very, very quickly and understand also what the organization needed pretty quickly through the fact that we had already established relationships. So I think these are all advantages. The main concern for me coming from within was the risk of, if you want, misunderstanding on what we needed to do. My main message has been from the very first day, Vodafone needs to change. And I didn't want to have any misunderstanding on, because I am the usual Margherita, things will continue as normal, which is why in my first message to the organization, I had to say straight away, make no mistakes, things are going to be tough because change is tough and we need to have radical change.
But please allow me a follow-up question on this, because you had been part of the top team for 5 years. As the CFO, you had to defend the strategy of the organization publicly. So you were also quite connected to the past. And as you said, you then arrived and you said, okay, we are wherever we are, and that requires significant change. Did this involve a little bit of tension or discomfort or not at all?
I think all what we are doing and we have been doing in the last year implied tension and discomfort. But I think all companies need tension and discomfort to be successful and to win. The point around the past versus the present, first of all, I would say your own perspective changes because it's very different to be the CEO who is responsible to set the strategy for the company, as opposed to be the CFO that is supporting the delivery of the strategy. And my approach has been the same I was describing earlier, which is whether it was something done by Margherita herself or not yesterday, it doesn't really matter to me. What matters is, from the perspective we have today, in the industry we have today, in the competitive environment we have today, what are the right actions to do? And if this involves changing versus a decision taken in the past, that's fine and will continue to be fine. I also want us to be always conscious of the mistakes we do. And it may well be that in the last 12 months, we will have done a number of mistakes. We just need to be able to acknowledge it and just move on and continue to effectively do what's right for the moment.
Now, since taking over, you have been described personally very positively in the press. The organization, however, keeps being challenged a little bit and being doubted a little bit. And so I guess when you read your own press, it's quite encouraging. But I'm imagining that sometimes for Vodafone employees, it's probably not super easy. How do you keep the organization's morale up and when things are not going as well as we would like for an extended period of time? How do you prevent self-doubt and lack of confidence or even helplessness to develop?
First of all, let me say, I think you are far too generous on the press point. But I think this is a really good question because We have been going through and are going through difficult times as an organization. I would say what for me matters is two things. The first is that it's given how hard change is, it is really essential that people understand it and that it resonates. And I strongly believe in something I would describe, I think it's going to be incorrect words, but I think there is a wisdom in organizations. And I think actually the organizations understand pretty quickly if the change is going in the right direction or in the wrong direction. So I would say the first point is that change needs to make sense and needs to build positively and be seen as maybe difficult, but logical from the organization overall. And then the second point has to be results. People need to see us winning. And this is really essential. I mentioned to you earlier that my main starting point has been how we interact with our customers and resolving all sorts of basics of putting the customers as the central focus of our organization. Well, this is not only something that obviously makes sense to all the people in Vodafone, and I need to say it's something that has given me a lot of satisfaction to see how much energy this has mobilized. We have driven change through changing, obviously investing more, changing careers, incentives, everything, but and the culture is falling pretty fast. But we have also seen the results. So I'm now publishing results with a mix of financial KPIs and customer satisfaction KPIs. I'm putting them out there also for all investors to see, because I think it's essential for the long-term structural health of the company. And this is an area where, because we have started off very quickly and our teams have mobilized because they believed in it, we have seen some early successes. We have seen, for example, in the UK, which is our own market, our customer satisfaction become the leader, the number one in the market, which is not something that had ever happened before in our history. And of course, we have seen revenue starting to go back to positive. Europe is growing, Germany is growing. Vodafone Business revenues are accelerating. It's really essential that now people see the results and see some winning. Although it takes time, we are a momentum business. Lots of things will remain difficult. They need to clearly move in the right direction.
So what I'm hearing is the strategy that we proposed had to be sensible enough that people could relate to it. And then it becomes an issue of building momentum by making sure that, of course, our efforts will pay dividends down the road, but we also want to make sure that they start paying dividends quickly enough for people to develop confidence and trust that this is working.
Exactly. I think that's the perfect summary. I would add that the strategy needs also to be communicated appropriately. And again, we're talking about all the recipes as if they were working, but let me say it once again, we're at the beginning of our journey.
But does it mean that you may have overinvested in some areas in order to generate these early wins? I mean, early wins don't always materialize just spontaneously. So were there some conscious decisions that you made to say, I know this could work in 3 years, but I want it to work within 6 months? So did this influence some lower level decisions and some investments?
There is a limit to what you are describing, which is you cannot trade the long term for the short term. So it's important to have a sense of progress, but the actions that deliver it should not come at the expense of anything more structural. Again, if we talk about customers, by investing more, we're spending much more money in delivering good quality basic service to our customers. You don't see the results straight away because it will take time for the customers to appreciate that, for your churn to reduce, but it still is the most important thing you need to build over time.
Understood. Now, one of the articles I read preparing for this discussion said that since becoming CEO, you contributed to, and here I quote, reduce the macho culture. And this is not a quote from you. This is a quote from from an FT article. So reduce the macho culture in what had been perceived. And again, this is the article saying an old boys club. And the organization has become, the article said, a more inclusive and more pleasant environment in which to work. So they give you credit for already changing significant aspects of the leadership culture and the leadership environment. First of all, does this sound right to you? And what did you do in order to start generating these positive effects?
What I recognize is that change is happening. I'm not sure I would recognize all the wording which has been used, in the sense that I think it's a struggle to define the current environment as more pleasant. We are doing difficult things, and actually one of the changes that we need from a cultural perspective is to move away from what I would call an excessively consensus-driven culture. A culture where internal negotiations were, as if you want, extensive. We have talked about the balance between the center and the markets earlier. And from my perspective, there was not enough speed and agility. And I think that in order to win, we need the intensity of a high-performing organization, which means being able to disagree with each other more. And disagreeing can mean breaking eggs. Of course, we can also disagree agreeably, and we are, of course, inclusive in terms of I really like to get challenged from all sides, but it needs to be tough challenge, direct challenge, and it needs to include some tough discussions and some tough decisions as well.
One of my colleagues referred to this as it's a good idea to be kind, it's not a good idea to be nice. So what you're saying is, look, we try to be caring, but we are also introducing a more disciplined and driven culture. Fair enough. I think the articles were also referring, if I may, to a sense of openness toward basically more gender diversity. And I guess that's probably connected to the fact that you are one of only 10 female CEOs at the helm of a FTSE 100 company. Now, I don't know what the right percentage is, but 10% doesn't sound like the right number. And so I guess maybe let me ask the question differently. Should organizations do more to facilitate, or at a minimum to enable, more women progression to the top? And if so, what should they do?
So by definition, the answer is yes. I can maybe refer back to a finance experience there, because obviously I've always had, as a woman, a priority on this front. And when I became CFO, I quickly realized that also in the CFO space, if you looked across European multinationals, the sort of large listed companies of Europe, the percentage was the same. Only 10% of the women were CFOs. And what we have done there is I created a little network. I suggested to the 35 to come together, and most of them have agreed to, in an initiative which actually is still running after me, called Next Gen Women in Finance, which is basically women helping other women. So the women CFOs who have already made it to the top, identifying every year the top women at the next level down, the next generation, to dedicate some time to them, mentor them, exchange experiences, and give them visibility. Not something involving, you know, third parties, just women for women. And I'm very proud. I need to say it's taken a life of its own, and it's continuing beyond me with my old colleagues. I think that it's really important that women think about this, and obviously everyone thinks about what are the initiatives that can remove the obstacles. I think we are seeing progress, but ultimately the biggest obstacle, in my opinion, remains the fact that the definition of successful leadership, like areas you will be working on, is still very much informed by the man's profile. And more often than not, as a woman, the advice that has been given to me to be successful in my career, and I think the advice women get every day, is to be a bit more like a man. And this is profoundly wrong.
And what I'm hearing from you is, and I knew it was wrong and I've resisted it.
Yes, and also I think we need more women and women helping other women, precisely because we need to show that actually there are different leadership styles.
Thank you for this. And actually, it's connected to my last question, Margherita, which is, You love your job because?
Because I have the privilege to work with fantastic people that love Vodafone as much as I do. That would be, in a nutshell, why I am really passionate about the work I do. And really, people are everything. I'm sure you get also that answer very often. So being part of a fantastic team that has the same passion of driving Vodafone to success is what gets me going.
And I also heard from you this notion of, and we create priorities for ourselves and we go after these priorities and then we succeed together. I also heard this in some of your previous answers. There's really this notion of winning as a team and making the organization better. I sense that this is a big driver for you.
Yes, that's true.
Margherita, thank you very much. We wish you all the best and continued success in your transformation of an iconic organization. And I look forward to reconnecting maybe in a few months or in a few years and hearing about your progress. All the best.
Thank you very much. Thank you.